it's good for us to recognize it as we have this last week. That He is in control. One day, it will not just be snows that keep us at home next to our fireplaces and with our furnaces running, but there will be a final judgment. There will be a moment of reckoning. He'll return through the clouds. He will be seen by all. We will, following those who have died in Christ, rise to meet Him in the air, and thus we shall always be with Him. We have assembled on this day, and most of the days, despite the snow, when it wasn't particularly dangerous, you know, we've always come to recognize that fact. We are His creation, we are His children, we are His subjects. And we hope that in humility, as we were studying this morning, and we'll again to some extent be studying tonight, but in humility and not in arrogance and pride, in submission and not with some sense of vengeance or having rights that we would exercise, you just recognize that we are the servants of a living God. So thank you all for being here. I'm appreciating the example that you set, the encouragement that you are. The title slide this morning is kind of nondescript, I think of it, but we are looking at the Sermon on the Mount. Please open up to Matthew 5. We'll be looking at that some more in just a moment. But last week's title slide was from essentially this very same area, but was looking off to the right, which is much more photogenic. You've got the Plain of Gennesaret down there. I've got Mount Arbel, and then the plateau that's called the Horns of Hattin rising above even that. So it's really a little bit prettier, I guess. But this is what you would see if you looked off to the left. And so from this location, where apparently Jesus presented the sermon on this mount, one is able to see the full 5-mile width of the Sea of Galilee, and then looking, you know, off to the right, but out of sight, down the length of it, about 13 miles. It is a marvelously fitting setting to enjoy the glory, the beauty of God, but also a very appropriate one, very easy for people to gather in, natural location for preaching. The main reason I wanted you to see this particular picture, though, is just to recognize that Jesus had made Capernaum His hometown and base for the vast majority of His preaching several years up in Galilee. This is Capernaum right down here. And just beyond this structure here, just out of sight, is what is thought to be, and there's actually a fairly good argument for, is thought to be the actual house that Peter had lived in there with his mother, and that is the location then of a miracle. And from the archaeological diggings, at least, it's quite a unique structure there in Capernaum, in that apparently, and at a very early date after Christ, it was then converted into a church building, not a synagogue, but into what was apparently used for Christian purposes. So at any rate, you can see that this very prominent town on the north shore there would then be easily able to collect people from the surrounding areas. We saw in the introductory class, we're told that that's the case. And they would be able to then travel easily along these shores. They would be able to ascend this hill, which is, you know, very gentle slopes, and then by the thousands would be able to listen to Jesus, as we have been doing. First, though, remember the foundation of everything that's found in Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 20. Now, Jesus is most upset throughout all of His preaching with the Pharisees, depicted, I thought, fairly well in this particular, I don't know if it's a movie or a play or what it was that was going on there, but you can see that the leaders among the Jews were extremely wealthy, extremely powerful. Appropriately enough, we've been studying thoughts about arrogance, conceit, and boasting for 2 weeks now in the morning class with regard to the First Corinthian letter, where the Corinthians had such terrible problems with that. And here is the epitome in these men of arrogance and conceit and wielding their power very injudiciously, unfairly, favoring friends and condemning those who are innocent because of their poverty, couldn't pay them off, that sort of thing. But notice that in Matthew chapter 5, in verses 17 through 20, Jesus says, "Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill," that is, to live perfectly, to manifest in His life. Were Jesus to break any of the Old Testament commands, He would be then unfit to be our sacrifice. We needed a sinless sacrifice by the law's standards. So He didn't come to annul it, He came to live it, He came to fulfill it. And then he continues there in verse 18, "Truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until all is accomplished." Whoever then, and this certainly would include himself as the speaker on this auspicious occasion, whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and so teaches others shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, Jesus declares, so that's precisely what he's doing, whoever keeps and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. These men, as we saw in Matthew 23:13 last week, would not enter into that kingdom. They might have, they could have, but they were refusing. And the passage just says also they were barring the way. They were prohibiting those who wanted to. And so Jesus, one of the first sermons that that we have recorded, so fully at least, but extremely early in his preaching, before thousands of people, is taking these men to task. He is saying they've gotten it wrong. They have not been teaching Moses' law correctly. If you don't do better than these men, then you're never going to see the inside of the kingdom of heaven. You're not going to be a part of God's people. Now, last week, we looked at the first of six contrasts that Jesus establishes next in this sermon. Prepare yourself, I'm about to abuse you mightily, because there are six of these contrasts. Last week we looked at the first, Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 through 26. But this morning we're going to look at the remaining five. These, all six of them, do precisely and exactly the same thing, which is why we're going to go pretty rapidly. Each and every one of these statements, "you've heard this, but I say that," is in contrast to the mistakes the Pharisees had made. Jesus is setting the record straight. He's not annulling the law. He's fulfilling the law. He's not the least in the kingdom. He's the greatest in the kingdom. So he is teaching what Moses' law says. The law that he is under. The law that these people are under. The law that they'll be under for the next 3 years. So last week we saw, just taking two of the verses from that section in verses 21 and 22. "You've heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder." Well, Moses had said that much, and surely that was true. But see the addition, "and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. Whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. Whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the..." It's a very poor translation in most translations, brethren. The word is Gehenna. Refers to the Valley of Hinnom that is immediately adjacent to Jerusalem, but a two-hour drive south, south of where they stood. But, you know, this Gehenna, this location, is something they knew well as, an accursed place where Molech was an idol in the Old Testament times, and the Jews, worshiping this idol, had sacrificed their children inside the idol, in which was kept a great fire burning, and by which they killed their own children. So this Valley of Gehenna was renowned as being an abysmal place of idolatry, but also, you know, as a place that is associated with fiery destruction and sinfulness, because they, committed this abomination of human sacrifice. But all that aside, brethren, the point that we made last week is this is exactly what Leviticus 19 and 18 had taught. Leviticus 19 verse 18 says, "You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." So what Jesus did, and we studied this in more detail last week, was to say, these Pharisees, your righteousness better be, superior to theirs. These Pharisees allowed people to do virtually anything as long as they didn't kill somebody. So, what Moses said was true, you shouldn't commit murder. But you also should not be angry with your brother. This the Pharisees have terribly neglected. You can't take vengeance on them. You can't even bear a grudge. You're to love them. So, he's setting the record straight. Moses had always taught this. Moses taught this in Leviticus 19. Jesus is just explaining the difference between how the Pharisees were neglecting the fullness of the law, allowing people to be angry and mistreat their brethren, when that too had always been forbidden. Now, with that under our belts from last week, we're going to continue now and try and get through all five of these statements. But please notice, at the end of the first one, the inherently, unavoidably, and necessarily Jewish nature of what he just taught. He says in verses 23 and 24, "If therefore you are presenting your offering at the altar..." This has not been done since Christ. The altar's gone. There is no altar anymore in Jerusalem. "But if at that time, for these people who are under that law," and that's the law Jesus is teaching, "if they were presenting their offering at the altar and remembered their brother had something against them." Not that they committed murder, but that the brother was angry. Something the Pharisees allowed, but Moses never did. "If you remember this, then leave," verse 24, "your offering before the altar. Go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, then come and present your offering. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you're with him on the way, in order that your opponent may not deliver you to the judge, the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Truly I say to you, not come out of there till you pay the last cent." So in 23 and 24, brethren, this is Moses' law. This is during the temple's sacrifices. This is what the Jews are supposed to get out of Jesus' sermon at this time. And Moses had always taught this, Leviticus 19:18, which forbid the anger that the Pharisees allowed. And so these Jews, if they are to believe Jesus, if they are to get into the kingdom of heaven, they're going to have to do better than those Pharisees. They're going to have to accept all of Moses' law like Jesus did. They're going to have to strive to fulfill that law the same way Jesus was, so that they can be great in the kingdom. Now then, let's take on the remaining five. So we see how Jewish this is. We see how it's couched in terms of first century Mosaic law in the first one very prominently. I think Jesus did that on purpose so that no mistake should be made. He's teaching Jews how to be Jews while they're under Jewish law, so that all can be prepared for the kingdom. Now in Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 and following, "You've heard it was said, you shall not commit adultery." And again, that is a quote from a portion of Moses' law. "But I say to you," so Jesus is contrasting his teaching with something. Is he contrasting his teaching with Moses' law or something else? Well, let's see. In verse 28, "I say to you, everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out, throw it from you. It is better that one of the parts of your body perish than for your whole body to be thrown into Gehenna. 30, and if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off, throw it from you. Better," bear in mind, you'd still be physically alive if you did either of these two things, "it's better for you that one of the parts of your body perish than for your whole body to be cast into that awful valley of destruction, where prisoners, as we learned throughout New Testament and other history, were thrown as a matter of insult at that time. Now, here's the big deal, though. In these verses, is Jesus teaching something unknown to Moses? This would be news to Moses. Is this something unknown in the pages of all the old law? Did Jesus say, "Well, Moses said that, but I want to tell you something different than what Moses said"? Or is Jesus continuing his contrast between the mess that the Pharisees had made out of Moses' law, their refusal to keep it, the traditions they'd heaped upon it? Is Jesus arguing then with the Pharisees' misapplication so that he can help these people have a superior relationship to the law, a righteousness better than that of the Pharisees? Or is he supplanting Moses with some new law? So the big question is the second part. But I say to you, everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart, a part of Moses' law or not? Was that taught in the old law? Did Exodus 20, verse 17 say, for instance, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor? What is it to lust after your brother's wife? It's to covet her. What is it that Moses forbid in the Ten Commandments? Commandment number 10. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, wife, male servant, female servant, ox, donkey, anything. So, brethren, the concept that the Pharisees had, as long as you don't commit murder, you can be angry, you can be vengeful, you can harm and abuse your brethren, you know, that's okay. You just can't kill them. Jesus says, but I say to you, you can't harm your brethren, you can't bear a grudge, you can't be angry with them. Moses never allowed that, and Pharisees are wrong. He's doing the same thing here. Pharisees taught, you shouldn't actually commit the act of adultery. But they were neglecting the rest. That if you look at a woman with lust, which is coveting her in Exodus 20, you've already committed adultery with her in your heart. So Jesus is saying, the righteousness of the Pharisees is not righteousness at all. The righteousness of the Pharisees is not enough at all. If you stop where they stop, you're not keeping Moses' law. You need to know that Moses forbid looking on a woman with lust in your heart, and the Pharisees don't. So I'm telling you, do it Moses' way, as you read in Exodus 20:17, and not the Pharisees' way. Now, in verse 29 and 30, he's just emphasizing that. It is so important for you Jews to avoid this behavior that it'd be better if you cut off an arm or, you know, gouged out an eye than to engage in it. That's how serious Moses was in his law. Avoid the thought as well as the deed rather than following these Pharisees who are allowing the thought and then forbidding only the deed. Let's do it again in Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 and 32. In this case, the shortest of them all, six comparisons. This one only has two verses, so this whole thing is in 31 and 32, so it's all on the screen there as well. Jesus said, it was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. Now be real careful here. That's a quote. You may have noticed I'm pulling these directly out of the digital version of my New American Standard Bible, which has, you know, a tremendously helpful tool by capitalizing words in the New Testament that are direct quotes from the Old. So every time you see direct quote, all caps, it is a direct quote from the Old Law. Now be careful here. It was said. Please note he doesn't say it was written. He says it was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. Now, in this case, we need to remember that the Pharisees would say that too. But they wouldn't practice it. The Pharisees would say, you should only divorce a wife, how? With a certificate of divorce. But I say to you, everyone who divorces his wife except for unchastity. The word is our word we get porneia from, no surprise following the previous contrast. You know, except for this sexual misbehavior makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So the question is, what have the Pharisees made out of the capitalized words? And what they had made out of those words, was it what Moses taught or not? Now this is where I'm going to abuse you by far the worst with a teaser that I really hope will get you into the Sunday morning Bible class. Okay? Because There's a whole chapter dedicated to this in 1 Corinthians 7. There's also Jesus in Matthew 19, which is toward the end of his preaching, not at the beginning, like this. There's additional information in Deuteronomy 24. There's a lot of information about this. So, I'm going to give you an extremely light touch right now. For the fullness of it all, come to the 1 Corinthians class. We're going to discuss all those other passages in detail. And at that time, when I have a lot of time, several classes, I'll prove to you what I just want you to trust me on right now. You have an honest face. What I'm going to say is true. But I can't take the time to go and explain it all to you this morning. Here's what the Pharisees were doing. They read Moses' law. Whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. They ignored the fact that Moses required that she be guilty of adultery, and that's the only person that should ever be given a certificate of divorce. They ignored all of that. And then they said, you read this in Matthew 19, they said, well, hey, Moses said we can divorce our wives for any reason we like. And we are, have been. We just cast them off willy-nilly. We just have to be sure to give them a certificate of divorce. The certificate of divorce is God's way of saying you can divorce a woman for burning the toast. You can divorce her because you don't like her hairdo. You can divorce her because you found a prettier woman. You can divorce her for any cause. Just give her the certificate of divorce. Now, in these other passages, I'll establish that. You can study on your own, Matthew 19. They were quoting the verse, misapplying it brutally, and by the hundreds of thousands, divorcing their wives and just casting them off to the street, kids included, because they thought they could as long as they had the certificate of divorce. Jesus says, never unless she's guilty of fornication, unless she's guilty of adultery. And you can see this in Deuteronomy 24. Deuteronomy is Moses. Verses 1 through 4. When a man takes a wife, so far so good, happens she finds no favor in his eyes because he's found some indecency in her. He found the unchastity. In the original Hebrew it says, he found a matter of nakedness in her. Then if he finds that she's guilty of sexual immorality, what that means, you can give her a certificate of divorce and put it in her hand and send her out of your house. But that is the only reason to send her out of your house. So it continues. If she leaves, becomes another man's wife, guilty as she can be, caught her committing adultery. But he hadn't got any witnesses, so he can't put her to death. What's he to do? Well, she's guilty. I saw it. But I don't have a witness, so I can't put her to death. Well, then, okay. She's guilty. You saw it. Give her a certificate of divorce. She's an adulteress, and send her out. But if you do that, she leaves and goes and becomes another man's wife. That's perfectly legal under Moses' law. She's guilty, but she can marry another man. And if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce, so she did it again apparently, and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or even if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband, who sent her away because she committed adultery, is not allowed to take her again to be his wife. Since she has been defiled, that is, she's had a sexual relationship with another man now, she can't come back to the first one. That's an abomination before the Lord. You shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. So, brethren, I know this is big, a lot of other passages, it's hard, but here's what was going down. Pharisees were using the certificate of divorce as an excuse to divorce their wives for any cause at all. And Jesus says, absolutely not. Moses never taught that. There is only one reason for a divorce, and therefore only one reason you'd ever give anybody the certificate. She has to be guilty of adultery. If she's not, then you're a sinner. The guy that marries her is in sin. This will not be. Matthew 5:31 is a perfectly inspired translation and commentary of Deuteronomy 24. Whoever sends his wife away because she's committed adultery, matter of indecency, or unchastity, Everyone who divorces his wife except for that makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. More on makes her commit adultery later. I've got you now. The Sunday morning class is going to be a lot bigger from now on, right? Everybody here will be there in the upcoming weeks. It'll be a few weeks, but we'll get to it. So there is Jesus saying, Pharisees got it wrong. They're abusing their wives and Moses' law. Don't you ever use that certificate unless she's committed adultery. Now let's go to Matthew 5, 33 through 37, number 4. Again, you've heard the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. It's all caps. That's a direct quote. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it's the throne of God, or by the earth, for it's the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king, nor shall you make an oath by your head. You cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no, and anything beyond these is of evil. So, there's the full text. On the screen, I've just got the first two verses. You've heard the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but you shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But, now here's the question. Is Jesus saying, well, that's all Moses said, but I'm Jesus, I'm going to give you a new law. I'm bringing you something higher. You can't find what I'm about to say in Moses' law. This is altogether unique to Christianity, which won't exist for three more years. But, I'm telling you Jews on this hill right now, you heard the ancients were told this, but I'm going to say, make no oath at all. Either by heaven, it's the throne of God, or any of these other things. Just don't make oaths. So the question becomes, is Jesus comparing his new teaching that's never been heard before and will apply to Christianity, is he contrasting that with Moses, or is he contrasting what he says, Jesus says, the proper understanding of Moses with the Pharisees' misunderstanding of Moses? What did Jesus say? Moses said, don't make false vows, fulfill your vows. I say, make no oath at all. What did Ecclesiastes 5, verses 5 and 6 say? It is better you should not vow. How's that different from what Jesus said? It's Old Testament law. Better you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. What's exactly what Moses said? Do not let your speech cause you to sin. That's exactly what Jesus is saying. Do not say in the presence of the messenger of God it was a mistake. Comes time to fulfill your vow, they want, you know, the payback, and you tell the messenger, well, I can't, you know, it was a mistake. You can't do that. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? So, brethren, look carefully at Matthew 5, 33 through 37. Then you look at Ecclesiastes 5, 5 and 6. In what way, shape, or form are they different at all? They're not. Moses always intended that by saying you should never make false vows, but you need to fulfill your vows to the Lord. To teach people then, it's unwise to take vows at all. You're going to have to fulfill them. Be careful. So Jesus simply states what Ecclesiastes said, what was included by Moses all along, in which the Pharisees shredded. Just shredded. Jesus on another occasion is going to be all over their cases. You Pharisees who say that if you swear by the altar, well then you have to keep your vow. Or no, you don't have to keep your vow. But if you swear by the gold that's on the altar, then you do have to keep your vow. Remember that? I don't have time. I'm abusing you. But you should remember this. They were all the time doing this. They would swear. And then break them freely. Well, I swore by the altar, but I didn't swear by the gold. That's what they were doing, crossing their fingers behind their backs. And Jesus is saying, Moses never said you could do that. You better have a righteousness that's better than those Pharisees, because their righteousness is no righteousness at all. They're twisting Moses' law. They're abusing Moses' law. And I, Jesus, am teaching exactly what those 39 books of the Old Testament say. It is not smart to make vows, so don't do it. Question, brethren. In verse 34. I say to you, make no oath at all. Did Paul sin when he took his oath that we read about in the book of Acts? Well, of course not. He kept a vow. Because whether it's Moses, Jesus, or Christianity, brother, what has God always taught? If you make a vow, then what? You got to keep it, don't you? This is not hard to grasp. And if you start doing like the Pharisees, well, I swore by this but not by that, so when you come to collect, I'll just tell the messenger, oh, it was a mistake, you didn't understand. I was swearing in a manner that doesn't mean I have to pay. They can't get away with that because Jesus is not contrasting new Christian teaching with Moses' law. He is contrasting the truth of Moses' law with the abuse of it by those Pharisees. So now we come to verses 38 through 42. Number 5, you've heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Again, yeah, Pharisees always read the law before they broke it. But I say to you, do not resist him who's evil. Whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. If anyone wants to sue you, take a shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks of you, and don't turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. Now, brethren, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. It's Moses' law. Okay? Jesus now contrasts something. Don't resist the one who's evil, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. What is Jesus teaching that is so different from the law? Nothing. Now, here's a question for you. Under Moses' law, Christian law, or Eugene's law, or law of the federal government in the United States, when somebody commits a crime against you, do you have to sue them? You're going to break the law if you don't? Do you have to haul them into court? You got to haul everything that ever goes wrong in your life into court? Is that what Moses taught? No. By the way, how are the Pharisees amassing so much of their wealth? What was Jesus condemning that they were doing with the widows? See? Hauling everybody in and stealing legally their stuff. These Pharisees were bad dudes. Jesus is real unhappy about it. Thinks everybody's righteousness ought to surpass that. So yeah, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But look, go the extra mile. Don't resist. You don't have to sue people. And here's Leviticus 19:18 we've already read. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. I'm the Lord. Brethren, Old Testament or New, it was always the same. Just, you know, use the law for things that are really serious and don't abuse it the way these Pharisees are, these great lawyers that are stripping everybody, you know, of their possessions. Just don't do like they do. So finally, abusing you fully, we're coming now to the last, which is in verse 43. You've heard it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now, brethren, this is really helpful. Much like the first one, we now have the last one as bookends on whether or not Jesus is teaching something other than the law. Is he annulling the law or fulfilling it? Is he teaching the law or annulling the law? Is he the greatest or the least in the kingdom? Look at this one. You heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor. What's that? All caps. And you've also heard, hate your enemy. Is that in caps? Huh. Because what have they been hearing rather than reading? When you read it in Moses' law, it's one thing. When you hear it in the Pharisees' mouths, it's another. So you heard, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. And then to continue, the middle of 45, for he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good. He sends his rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax gatherers do the same? Don and I knew a tax gatherer, a guy who worked for the IRS. How many of you know your tax gatherer? They sure did in the first century, though, because those men were abusing the contracts they had, extorting money from each person individually when they reported to hand them the money, and stealing from them is why those taxpayers, gatherers rather, were hated so much and mentioned so often in the Gospels. But now watch this. If you greet your brothers only in 47, what do you do more than others? Do not even the... Oh, that's right. In Christ, there is no Jew or Gentile. After Christ's resurrection, there won't be Gentiles ever again because there's also not Jews. Now, the kingdom is open to all people. And the Jews are not special or favorite in any way because the gospel is universal. We did away with the law once it was fulfilled by Jesus and he became our sacrifice. So brethren, when you get advice about how you should treat people like Gentiles, tell me exactly how do you treat Gentiles now? This is purely Old Testament doctrine. This is purely Moses' law. These are Jews being taught how to obey Moses' law and quit following the Pharisees' corrupt practices. Hypocrites. All those Pharisees, don't, except Nicodemus. Don't follow those guys. Now watch this, brethren, again. I know this feels kind of old, but for the third time, what does Leviticus 19:18 say? You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Well, brethren, that includes neighbors that are mistreating you. It's like God sends rain and sun on the evil and the unjust. But just in case you got tired of Leviticus, kind of the foundation of all things, we'll use Proverbs here too. If your enemy is hungry, what? Give him food. If he's thirsty, what? Give him water. For you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. Now, this burning coals is, you're sure going to make him think. He did you wrong. You did him right. That really slows people down. Hard to keep doing wrong to people who keep doing right. Do you have to sue him? Well, we've already learned that. Let's use Moses' law properly, Jesus says. So now, you Jews, I know how you treat the Gentiles. I'm going to use that as a comparison because you're still under the old law. I know how you do with the tax gatherers. I understand all that. But you are not permitted to hate your enemy. Not in Leviticus, not in Proverbs, not anywhere in the Old Testament are you permitted to behave like this. So, we'll talk about hating, you know, with David, those that were persecuting him, and it's a whole different context. I mean, I understand about these other passages. I just want you to see in the Sermon on the Mount in Galilee, the start of Jesus' ministry, 3 years before he'll die on the cross or establish Christianity, when the people there are under Moses' law, and he's just said before the six contrasts, one verse before the six contrasts, your righteousness is going to have to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Now let me tell you what they say about Moses' law, and I'll tell you what Moses' law actually said. I'm going to do it six times. And in the beginning with the altar, and in the end with the Gentiles, he is saying, Jews, keep Moses' law. And do not follow the traditions and customs, abuses and corruptions and perversions of those men, the scribes and Pharisees, whose righteousness is no righteousness at all. Because they're breaking Moses' law. This is what Jesus is doing in the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. Now then, if... This is Sermon on the Mount and Jews, and after all of that, we are, though, under a new law, Christianity today. You are not a Christian. Brethren, you got to do better than the scribes and Pharisees before you even enter the kingdom. So, friend, if you're not in the kingdom yet, yes, it will require a serious evaluation of your life. Who am I? How do I live? And who do I live for? It'll then require an admission. I have not been serving my God as He would have me serve. I'm guilty of sin. There's anything I can do about that. I need to repent. That is, change my mind. I need to reject who I am and what I do and the standard by which I live so that I can embrace God's standard so much higher than mine. I then need to confess with my mouth unto salvation, to finish the phrasing in Romans 10, verses 9 and 10. And after that public confession that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, you should be baptized, that is, immersed in water in the name of Jesus, for the forgiveness of your sins. To quote from Acts 2:38 and Romans 6, rise to walk in newness of life. So put yourself among the Jews. Say, I'm going to be a faithful disciple of the law that I'm now under. Put yourself now in the shoes of all of those today who've lived 2,000 years after the Jew-Gentile distinction was abolished and the temple was burnt to the ground, never rebuilt. And ask yourself, am I ready to serve the Lord instead of me? To be forgiven because He did fulfill the law, died to be the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. And if today, then is that day of decision for you.